Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Over the 3+ years we've been on the air, we've interviewed well over 200 people. We've talked with singer-songwriters, actors and theater directors, scientists, chefs, lots of authors, TV and radio personalities, and many more. The only real criteria we set for choosing guests is that they have good stories to tell. Today, we're going to catch up on the current activities of three guests who told us great stories when they visited the Two-Way Street studio. One of them was Diana Nyad, the fierce, passionate ocean swimmer who at age 64 fulfilled a lifelong ambition to make the solo swim across the Gulf of Mexico from Havana to Key West, Florida. She had tried and failed 4 times starting in her 20s. But now she's got a daunting new goal, walking across the United States. We'll get to that in a little while, but first here's a portion of our conversation with Nyad when she came into our studio in the fall of 2015. We started by playing her a clip of that triumphant moment she stumbled onto the beach at Key West at the end of her harrowing swim.
One is, we should never, ever give up.
Okay.
Two is, you're never too old to chase your dreams.
That's right.
Amen, sister.
Three is, it looks like a solitary sport, but it's a team.
She's got to go to second.
Diana Nyad, where did that happen?
Well, you know, the odd thing about it, Bill, is it's such a long journey and a moment that's so, you know, rife with emotion. It's like when you see Roger Federer and he wins Wimbledon and he goes to his knees and cries on the grass, it's not because he won that match. It's the entire career. It's all the people who suffered through with him, who believed in him. It's all the losses. It's all the hundreds of thousands of hours of practice strokes. So you can imagine, this is a 35-year dream. I had started it when I was 28 years old and finally, you know, stumbled up on that beach at the age of 64. So there was a deep emotion of pride and satisfaction and team and journey, and that was Smathers Beach, Key West. From what I am told, there were a few thousand people there, and they were crying. They were highly emotional, and I realized afterwards, I was pretty stunned. You could hear in my last sentence there, I was going down, and I wished I could have stayed there for hours and hugged everybody and been with my team, but there just wasn't anything left. But you know what, Bill? I really believe that people responded to my story not as an athletic event. Clearly it's that. It's an endurance achievement. Those things go without saying. But it was a moment of watching a person get knocked down and fail over and over again and refuse to give up.
When you hear that audio again, does it still conjure up emotion in you?
It does, but it's not, ironically enough, because you're playing the triumphant moment on the beach. I rarely think about that victorious moment. I can picture it, especially when I see pictures or hear the audio. But, you know, for me, and I had to, didn't I? This destination of Florida was seeming more and more elusive with each try. And people, good swimmers, have been trying since 1959. Not that I lost faith in it. I believed we were going to see those lights of Key West. We were going to see those palm trees one day. But I must say that I was coming closer and closer to believing that the odds were highly against it.
So your speech was made more difficult because of the sores that you had in your mouth, and we'll talk about that. But and the sound, the crowd noise was loud. Tell us what those three things were you said again.
You know, you would find this funny, and I'm just going to admit it, in a very overblown ego sort of way, when you're out there training for constant grueling hours. You do a 12-hour swim one day, you're lying vomiting on the floor, and then you get out of the fetal position and do a 13-hour swim the next day, and blah, blah. So that training, tougher than the swims themselves, frankly, if you look at it overall, I always, Bill, had this oration planned. When I finally see, make it to the other shore. Imagine the pearls of wisdom that are going to, you know, I'm going to be quoting Browning and grasping for the eternity. But it didn't happen that way. I've never said those words before. I don't know where they came from. I think those were just truly the authentic messages I swam with.
Let's say them again.
Never, ever give up. And, you know, am I the first to say that? We can go back to Churchill, and I'm sure Napoleon, and certainly Teddy Roosevelt. But the idea is there's only one sure way to fail. You just don't try again. And I think a lot of people, they feel that giving up is easy. Quitting's easy. But you really want something. You have another shore. Maybe you're battling cancer. Maybe you've always wanted to write that novel, but things didn't turn out that way. Well, it's not only never too late, but you can get knocked down and the publisher isn't going to publish your novel. And the doctor has more bad news for you. If you just don't give up, chances are you're going to get to the other side of whatever you're trying across. You're going to find a way.
And number two?
You're never too old to chase your dreams.
You were 64 when you finally, on the fifth attempt.
And I might add a better athlete. And I'm not saying that the lines don't come on the face, the breasts droop a little lower than they used to. I'm always shocked when I look in the mirror these days. I say, is that really where those breasts are riding these days? So I don't deny my age. I'm 66 now. But I'll tell you something, standing on that shore on Smathers Beach, Key West, at 64, I truly believe I was not only, yes, we all feel more mature, more enlightened, more, you know, embracing of this life we get to lead, more appreciative as we get older, but I actually was a better athlete at 64 for this sport than I ever was in my 20s.
What's the third thing?
It looks like a solitary sport, and doesn't it? I mean, you know, how many hours do you see the left arm and the right arm? Nobody else is in the water. You're the one, except, you know, my shark divers, but you're the only one swimming. And on the other hand, how would I ever in a million years have achieved this without Bonnie, the head of my head handler team, and my shark divers? How am I going to thank those guys? They put their life ahead of mine.
Singing is very important to you as you're on these marathon swims. And at one point, you said that Emily Sayers, of course, who we all know here in Georgia, especially one of the Indigo Girls, she pointed out something interesting about your song selection, didn't she?
I showed Emily Sayers my little playlist. I have about 85 songs. And they're of my generation. It's Dylan, Joplin, Beatles, Neil Young.
Sounds good to me.
It's not bad. Every one of them. And, you know, and I select them at times when I need them. I need Neil Young at 3 o'clock in the dark, desperate morning.
How does that work?
Which?
So you're singing Neil Young. You're swimming. It's 4 in the morning, it's dark, and how is that working? How is Neil Young singing? How are you?
I don't have headphones, so this is right. Just all my, and of course I'm not singing out loud, that would be absurd underwater, but I'm hearing as if I have a recording of Neil Young singing The Needle and the Damage Done, as if I can hear every breath, every guitar strum of that recording, and by the way, my stroke is a metronomic. Evidently, Emily Sayers told me from a music point of view, 4-4 time, because she said every song you've got on here is in 4-4 time. I said, you're kidding. I have no idea. And so when I'm out there, it just comes to me. I think I'm feeling like the sun is never going to come up again. This is going to be the first day in the history since the Big Bang that the sun will not be coming up. And I've just got to get through these hours of darkness. And I left arm, right arm, starting with, I decide I'm going to sing The Needle and the Damage Done 1,000 times in a row, literally, the whole song, exactly the way that Neil Young sang it, and I can hear it. I hear you knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby, can I have some more? Ooh, the damage done.
I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone, the damage done.
There is going to come a time when your body is going to begin to fail you. I mean, it happens to each and every one of us. As you point out, we are on a one-way street.
Yeah, sure.
How do you contemplate that moment or that series of moments when your body will not respond the
well,
way
I,
it has
you know,
now.
I don't think life works that way. Life is gradual.
Well, sure.
You know, so, for instance, I don't contemplate death right now.
You
I'm
don't.
Very vital, you know, and so, of course, we're all going to die, but as far as I can tell, unless there's an accident or, you know, an unforeseen, you know, situation that doesn't seem to be on the horizon for me. Let's say I'm going to die when I'm 96. I don't know. But at that moment, if you ask me then when I'm 96, how do you feel about dying? I'm sure that I will be contemplating it because you're close to it. Right now, I got nothing slowing down. Now, you could talk to me when I'm 86 and maybe some things are going to be slowed down and I can't do 1,000 jumping jacks in a quick, fast, you know, dynamic
well,
hurry.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah. But maybe I will. You know, I just met Jack LaLanne's widow. I mean, the woman's 85. She does 50 push-ups, nose to ground, all the way. So I don't put any preconceptions on that. You know, I will. The body, the organs are going to fail one day, and the muscles are going to shrivel, and I'm going to be 3 inches shorter than I am now. But you know, that happens gradually. You don't foresee that. You just keep going day to day as to where you are. And I'm still a badass at 66. What can I say?
Well, you're a badass, and Diana and I, Ed, you are a great inspiration to I think everyone who knows your story. As we close the interview, and I'm so happy that you've been here, there's only one thing to say to you. Onward. Onward.
Onward, indeed. You know, the conversation has been wonderful. I appreciate it very much.
Postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Or will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
When the microphones were turned off at the end of our conversation with Nayed, she told us about just what Onward meant to her. She said that she and her partner, Bonnie Stoll, would soon announce they were planning to undertake what Nayed calls the biggest walking initiative in American history. They plan to stage walks in every state of the Union and encourage thousands of Americans to join them. And just last month, they led 100 people on a 7-day, 132-mile walk from Boston to Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Now they have plans to stage walks from Philadelphia to New York City, Tucson to Phoenix, and Birmingham to Atlanta in the near future. We've always loved having singers and songwriters visit the Two Way Street studios. And many have come through our doors. Christian Bush of Sugarland, septuagenarian blues performer Beverly Guitar Watkins, Chris Thiele of the Punch Brothers, and now the host of Prairie Home Companion, Indigo Girl Emily Saliers, country music legend Whisperin' Bill Anderson, and others have all appeared on Two Way Street. In February, we did a show focused on what it takes to become a successful singer-songwriter in the Nashville music industry. We talked with Radney Foster. He's a veteran of the country music scene in Nashville. And as we talked, he told great stories about getting started in the business. You were born in Del Rio, Texas, which is way down there on the Mexican border.
Yes, sir, it is.
Right?
It is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And it is southwest Texas. It really is. Was a very Western world. You know, I had neighbors and friends who, you know, trailered their horses every morning to drive 40 miles to the ranch to work. You know, the a lot of sagebrush and cactus.
Your father was a lawyer.
He was.
What kind of lawyer?
He was a small town lawyer, which is a jack of all trades, whether it was probating a will or getting a kid out of jail who got caught with two joints in his back pocket, and in the 1960s that was a big deal. So kind of a little bit of everything. If you know, when I saw To Kill a Mockingbird And I saw Gregory Peck in that seersucker suit with those horn-rimmed glasses. I was shocked because I was like, well, that's my dad.
He also was a musician.
Yes, he was. He was a great singer and a guitar player, and he was a terrible guitar player. But he played enough to know 8 or 10 chords. And on any given Saturday night that I really remember, somebody brought the barbecue, somebody brought the potato salad, somebody brought the beer, and everybody brought an instrument, and they played music all night long.
This was in the 60s.
Yeah, and you know, they would play everything from a Hank Sr. song to that new song by that Puff the Magic Dragon by that Peter, Paul, and Mary group. You know, I mean, it didn't matter whether it was Fats Waller or, you know, a show tune or a country song or a folk song. If it was simple to play and they liked it, they would play it.
So listening to your father and his friends play really inspired you. How old were you when you picked up the guitar? Do you remember?
Probably about 10 or 11 years old.
Yeah.
Picked up my father's guitar.
You made a record called Del Rio, Texas, 1959, mm-hmm. honoring the year you were
born. When and where I'm from. And I did it because that album was, I think, I had been in a band called Foster and Lloyd, and we were, as much as we were a country band, we were a punk band. We were really part of that whole cowpunk thing that was going on in Austin, Los Angeles, and Nashville. And it was really cool because we would be, you know, playing one weekend with George Strait and the next weekend with Roy Orbison or Neil Young or, you know, or with other, you know, on festivals with people like R.E.M. and Husker Du. So it was really a disparate thing. And my first solo record, I kind of wanted to prove that I really, honest to God, loved country music and could make a stone cold country record.
I think I'm correct to say that the real breakout song from that was Just Call Me Lonesome.
Yes, sir. That first one was, and then also Nobody Wins.
Well, the reason I think of Just Call Me Lonesome.
Oh, it's a stone cold country song.
It's not only a stone cold country song, but it shows your Texas roots.
Oh, yeah,
song.
It's definitely
that's
got
a Texas
that.
Country
oh, big time.
Song.
It's a shuffle. You can dance to
you
it.
Play a little
sure.
bit, just a little of it.
With my fingers will work. I haven't warmed up. I'll just start with it. Just call me lonesome. Heartbroken and some. Cause I ain't got no one since you've been gone. You call me baby. Now I've got a new name. I don't need my old one. Call me lonesome from now on.
You left Tennessee to go with the University of the South in
yeah, I left
East Tennessee?
I went
you
to
left
school.
Texas?
I left Texas and went to University of the South, Suwannee, was right up the Monteagle Mountain from here.
Yeah.
And music was a hobby.
What were you studying?
Forestry and geology. I have a degree in both forestry and geology. And
I think I'm right that one evening...
Oh, yeah.
You made a phone call.
Well,
back
more than
to
a phone
Del
call.
Rio.
But here's what happened was that my band was playing up there, and a guy who was up, who was not a student there, he was with some alumni friends, and they heard my band, and the guy was kind of lit, and he came up, and he said, "I don't know Jack Squat about, you know, the music business, but I got a buddy who's a record producer in Nashville." I'm like, yeah, sure. So I write my phone number down, which is the payphone at the end of the hall in the dorm. So sure enough, 2 weeks later, I get tacked on my door. It says, "Call Brown Bannister." Well, that was a real name of a real guy who happened to be Amy Grant's producer. You know, this new ingenue who was taking the world by storm. And so I called him, and I ended up playing him 4 or 5 songs. And he said, "You got to have a serious talk with your folks about doing this for a living." And so right before I was supposed to go back for my senior year, I woke my mother and daddy up in the middle of the night. And I said, "You know, Mom and Daddy, I got something that's heavy on my heart and I need to talk to you about it." And my mother said, "Oh, good Lord, what is it now?" And I said, "I think God wants me to drop out of college so I can be a singer and a songwriter." My daddy sat bolt upright in bed at that point. And he said, I'm not making this up, exactly what he said. He said, wiped sleep out of his eyes, took the longest breath I've ever heard and said, "Son, I've known God a long, long time. and he does not want any son of mine to drop out of college to be a singer and a songwriter. He said, you heard wrong. You're not praying hard enough. You know? So they cut a deal, and I convinced the dean to let me take a year off, and I moved to Nashville for that year and, you know, thought I was going to be the next Elvis by the time I was 21, but nothing happened.
You went back and finished school. Who were the artists you were listening to in Nashville at that point? What year would this have been?
This would have been in 1980. And
you mentioned Amy Grant. Who were the artists?
The artists that I was really listening to were a lot of singer-songwriters. Certainly, I was listening to everything from the Beatles to Buck Owens to, you know, Neil Young and Crosby, Stills, Nash's music had a huge impact upon me. So did Waylon Jennings. I'll never forget buying Waylon Jennings' Honky Tonk Heroes record and going, who is this Billy Joe Shaver guy?
Right. Well, that Outlaw album, album, Willie, Waylon, Jesse Coulter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Phenomenal record.
Right. And, you know, and also the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band had come out with a record called Will the Circle Be Unbroken, which really put them together with these really traditional. That's how I discovered Doc Watson, and then bought Doc and Merle Watson on stage and bought a thumb pick and started finger picking.
The Carter family is on that. Mother Maybelle is on that record.
Merle Travis and Doc Watson playing a duet for the first time, meeting each other. I mean, there's so many things about that confluence of country and rock and songwriters that really wanted to make art, that really being an artist mattered. They weren't just trying to be a hit. I think those were the people who, and certainly Merle Haggard. I mean, those people were all speaking to me, and I was trying to write songs in those veins.
Bradney Foster did go on to become a successful songwriter and recording artist, but he probably made his biggest mark on the industry when a song he wrote was recorded by Keith Urban, who turned it into a mega hit called Rainin' on Sunday.
It ticks just like a time mix. It never lets up. You who said life was easy, the job is never through. It'll run us till we're ragged, it'll harden our hearts. And love could use a day of rest before we both start falling apart. I pray that it's raining on the sun.
Now Foster's released a new album called For You to See the Stars. At the same time, he's published a book of his short stories with the same title. Here's Foster singing the title song from the record.
The light that got me through. You walked right beside me down that road to hell and back. And in that midnight hour, I fell in love with you. Gotta get dark enough for you to see the stars shine like diamonds on black velvet.
Atlanta-based theater director Kenny Leon, the former artistic director of the Alliance Theater, has a new project that will take him back to Broadway next spring. It's a revival of Children of a Lesser God, which won the Tony Award for Best New Play in 1980. As he sometimes does, Leon's revival features a very unconventional casting choice that's already earning him praise. Before we get to that, let's listen to a portion of my interview with Leon from last August. We started by talking about the fact that he just won the Tony a few months earlier for direction of a play, Raisin in the Sun, starring Denzel Washington. I'd like to start, if I can, with what I assume has been one of the real highlights of your career. Let's listen, and the first voice we're going to hear is Clint Eastwood.
The American Theater Wing Tony goes to Kenny Leon.
Denzel. He's truly a theater inspiration. And I want to thank all the women of A Raisin in the Sun, LaTanya, Anika, Sophie. I love you to death. I love you, Jennifer. To my mother, I want to say thank you. Thank you. Thank you. To all the people in True Colors Theater in Atlanta who buy tickets to come see plays in Atlanta, to the folks that buy tickets and at Hartford Stage and theaters like Seattle Rep and the LA Theater Center. Thank you for all the people that get on buses and planes and trains to come to Broadway to see our work. I thank you. We do it for you. Thank you.
Kenny Leon, that must have been an extraordinary night, and there's a lot to unpack in what you said, starting with the fact that when you talk about Denzel three times, you're talking about Denzel Washington, who played Walter Lee Younger in that 2014 production of the show. Jennifer is your wife. And, of course, you thanked your mom three times. What was that night like?
It's interesting. I'm sitting here listening to that audio, and that's the first time I've heard that.
Is it really?
Yeah, it actually sort of made me kind of misty-eyed. I was like, wow.
I assume I'm right that winning the Tony was one of the highlights of your career so far, yes?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I would say winning the Tony was a spiritual event.
Why was it a spiritual event? Now that you bring that up, I can't move on the way I wanted to. Why was it a spiritual event?
Well, number one, during the week leading up to the Tonys, there was no discussion about Kenny Leon winning the Tony, being nominated for the Tony. It was not even in the discussion. And I remember going out of my apartment one day, I prayed to God that I said, you know, if you were to so make this happen, then I will continue to try to bring people closer to you by the work that I do on stage. And I knew that if this happened, it could have only been spiritual intervention. And so you're in your apartment, I'm leaving, getting ready to go to rehearsal for another Broadway show. They're on television, they're announcing nomination. But then when they did not name Denzel Washington in that category, I was like, turn the TV off. I walk out. So I'm on the, you know, halfway down the hall, and my agent calls me, and she's crying, and she's like, I said, what's wrong? She says, you got nominated for a Tony. I said, what? So I just looked up to God. I said, I just had that prayer. So I just fell on my knees and thanked God, and then recommitted myself to continue to do the work that we're doing in order to bring people closer to something that's good and right. But that on that evening, everything was a blur. You know, no one was predicting me to necessarily win in that category. But when my name was called, I had to replay it in my mind, like, did they say Kenny Leon? And I was so nervous that I didn't even kiss Jennifer. I just stumbled out into the aisle. And I heard someone, we were at Radio City Music Hall, heard someone on the upper balcony. And Radio City seats about 6,000 people, so everything looks a little blurry. And someone said, we love you, Kenny Leon. And I got really emotional because I said, that's a fan that bought a ticket to come to the Tony Awards and was betting that I would win that award.
We should point out that your Tony that night was one of several that production, the 2014 production of Raisin in the Sun, won. You won you won Tony for Best Revival that night, correct?
Yes, won Best Play, Best Direction. Sophie Okonedo won for Best Actress. something.
Sophie Okonedo had a wonderfully funny comment when she stood up there and got her award. She said that only you and Scott Rudin, one of the producers on the show, would think to cast a Jewish Nigerian Brit in one of the iconic roles of a young woman in Chicago.
That's interesting. That's the first time I've heard that, because when she was making her speech, I was downstairs in the press room giving interviews about winning my Tony. And then in the middle of the press conference, they said, wait a minute, Sophie just won. So then I responded to her winning, but I didn't hear her acceptance speech.
You have an interesting arc with Raisin in the Sun, because the 2014 production, you won your Tony for that. But you mounted that show on Broadway in 2004, 10 years earlier. Was that your first Broadway production?
Yeah, A Raisin in the Sun was my first Broadway production. And 10 years later, I had the opportunity to direct it again, which never happens in our business.
Yeah, so here's what's interesting to me about all that. You get your first shot at Broadway, and you bring in some pretty remarkable people to be part of the show, including your longtime artistic associate, Felicia Rashad. She was coming in to play what part?
Lena Younger.
But she didn't really want necessarily to play that role. Let's listen to what you said about trying to hire Felicia for that role, and then what she said about it.
Kenny Leon is always making me, talking me into doing things that I don't believe I can and know that I shouldn't. And I love that.
I remember offering the role to Felicia Rashad, and she says, no, Kenny, I'm going to pass on that because I'm not that old yet. And I said, Felicia, reread the play. Reread the play. The woman is young. She's 50, 55 years old. She's full of life. She's sexy, just like you. And what Felicia did after she read it, she said, you're right. And she made that her own.
So she did make it her own, and in fact, she won a Tony Award in 2004. I believe she was the first African-American actress to win a Tony Award in that production.
In a leading category.
Yeah.
Is somewhat shocking to me in 2004 that an African-American woman had never won as leading actress in a play.
You'd had a long artistic relationship with her, which started right here in Atlanta when you did a Pearl Clegg show. Pearl's been a guest on this show, called Blues for an Alabama Sky. It was the first time you'd worked with and met her, I think, yes?
Yes. And then I remember meeting Felicia in New York City in a rehearsal studio and trying to talk her into coming to Atlanta. And she said, I've heard about you. I know about you, Kenny Leon. I said, you know, let me just, and she said, well, you know. So anyway, so we had a great meeting that first time, and that relationship has continued now for 20 years or so. She is one of my favorite artists to work with because Felicia can do many things. So I say most actresses, they have one color. You say, could you do this? They paint it this color. Felicia can paint it 12 different colors. What shade of blue would you like? So her choices are always strong. It's always refreshing. It's always unique and different.
She was already a television star. The Cosby Show was already a huge success. But theater is something that she has never gotten away from, and a lot of that has to do with your partnership with her.
Well, she's a theater artist. She still takes acting classes to this day. She still takes movement classes. I love when she performed in Madea here in Atlanta, and hopefully one day we might get to do that again in New York somewhere.
I remember a couple things about that production of Raisin, the 2004 production. One of them is that you cast Audra McDonald, who is probably now the biggest star on Broadway, was already a star, but not the magnitude that she's achieved now. But what I remember most about it is, obviously, Raisin in the Sun is not a musical. Audra McDonald is one of the great Broadway singers, and beyond Broadway singing. But I remember that in one of the scenes of that show, she's kind of, I can't remember what the business is. She's walking around the house. She may be folding laundry even. And she starts singing a little bit. And I remember thinking, of course, if you have Audra McDonald in a play, the audience has to hear at least a couple of notes from her. Does that is that true? Did you guys do that intentionally?
As a director, I do everything intentionally. And I had a buddy that says to me, in this business, you have to be a snake or a snake charmer. And I'm certainly not a snake. So I'm always charming actors to get them to do what I need them to do. And I always build it around what they bring to it. And so you can't have Audra McDonald do anything and not hear her lovely voice.
Yeah.
That's part of who she is. So I'm always trying to figure out what is the truth of the character and the actor playing the part.
As we've already mentioned, Kenny Leon's new Broadway project is Children of a Lesser God. It's the story of the turbulent relationship between an unconventional speech therapist and his strong-willed deaf student. Joshua Jackson, who TV viewers may know for his role as the jilted husband in Showtime's The Affair, plays the teacher. But the real story about casting of the show is that of Lauren Ridloff. She plays the young deaf student. Ridloff's a former Miss Deaf America and a sign language model. Leon hired her to teach him sign language before he went into rehearsal with his cast. But as she worked with him, Leon realized she should play the lead female role, even though she'd never been an actress. During an out-of-town run of the show in upstate New York this summer, critics raved about Ridloff, saying she was sensational and an inspired choice for the role. Children of a Lesser God goes into rehearsal in February and opens in April.